This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Timmy, Mario, woohoo, you're number one. Woohoo, woohoo, and it's one of my friends on a sci-fi and screen. On Joy 94.9, number one. Woohoo.
Listen in to Sci-Fi and Scream with
Dill Stick.
With Dill Adler.
Only on Joy 94.9.
This is Dill Stick on Sci-Fi and Scream. Indie game releases are favourites for a lot of gamers, with titles like Minecraft springing to mind.
How do you get wood?
Watching informative murder porn?
Oh no, in this Minecraft forest, how do you get wood?
Punching trees?
Indie developers have been drawn into the next-gen console battle with Microsoft, Sony, and Nintendo's awkward courtship, developing kits, and policies. Joining me on Sci-Fi and Scream's Dill Stick is Defiant Development founder Morgan Jaffet. Thank you so much for spending some time with me this evening.
My pleasure, Dylan.
The next-gen consoles have been quite polarized with support for indie developers, with Microsoft first saying that they're not interested in indie developers, and now they're saying they are as long as they use their independent developers' kits. What's your industry opinion on the next-gen consoles?
So I think at the highest possible level, anywhere that makes it easier for indie developers to put their game is a win. You know, more places that we can put them is a huge win. And both Microsoft and Sony didn't do a fantastic job, particularly towards the end of kind of the PlayStation 3 and Xbox 360 life cycle, of making those platforms an easy place for indie developers to get onto. And it seems like both of them are making a real push this time around. As you mentioned, Microsoft initially kind of came out of the gates with no clear indie mandate, but now they've been pretty explicit that they're going to do everything possible to get people on there. And Sony have a really huge advantage with Mark Cerny being involved, and he set a very clear course early on, so I think we'll see a ton of really good indie stuff there out of the gate. But I think that's equally true for Microsoft, and in the end, indie developers win because we get new platforms to our work onto. And consumers win because there's a much better selection of games available, which is really what we all want.
And generally, indie games are the ones that hold fan favorship. I mean, look at something as simple as the idea of Minecraft, and look how popular that title is. Now, Defiant Development, you've had a large recognition from your game Heroes Call, which is the Diablo-style RPG for Android and iOS. Do you think that with the lack of transparency or the lack of enthusiasm from the big consoles, they've actually pushed developers away from the standard console landscape and into the mobile and tablet territory?
Look, I think a lot of things contributed to that, and part of it was exactly as you say, a lack of kind of enthusiasm in making gateways for non-traditional developers. There's been this huge rise in indie developers, small studios without a huge history or back catalogue, you know, coming out of nowhere and doing things like Minecraft. But all the way up and down the scale, you know, there's great stuff like Gone Home, Dear Esther, you know, even things that fall more in the gamey category. There's things like Antechamber, which is a great Australian indie game. There's all of this kind of creative work happening, and a lot of it's coming from not the traditional developers, you know, not big studios. And I think if you look at the way that big publishers are set up, they weren't particularly well poised to deal with those smaller people. They didn't have very open platforms. A lot of it was built on relationships and, you know, knowing the right people to get your stuff through. A lot of it had a lot of paperwork. You know, releasing a game on console, a lot of the team here come from Pandemic Studios and other console developers, so I've had a lot of experience releasing games on console, and it used to be a hideous pain in the ass. And these days, they're streamlining that process and making it much better. And really, that's where mobile won out. You know, they made it really easy to get your games out. And what that meant is there was this huge flood of content. And amongst all of that content, there were some really, really good games. And they captured people's attention. And in the process of kind of bred a completely new set of developers, which is fantastic.
And it's definitely beefed Australia's standing in the game world, because we've got so many developers out there on the portable devices. But over the past 5 years, there's also been quite a lot of Australian developers that have closed their doors. What's the environment like right now, from your opinion, for Australian video games and interactive medias?
I think it was actually, you know, in one sense, it was lucky that those studios closed when they did. Now, obviously, it was a really tough time. A lot of people lost their jobs, including myself and pretty much everybody who works here who worked for those big studios at that point in time. And it was tough, but it forced our hand really early on. So part of the reason that all those studios closed, they were all American-owned. The Australian dollar was really high, so we were more expensive. It made it tough to keep doing business in Australia for those American companies. So we were forced to go it on our own, and that meant that we got into the mobile side of things really early. So we have some great mobile developers, some great indie developers, and I think if there'd been comfortable studios for everybody to work at, we probably wouldn't have gone through that change. But as it was, we did some of that really early, and that put us in a real leadership position. And that directly responsible, I think, for some of the big successes we've had with mobile, free-to-play and independent gaming in Australia. So we now have a stronger industry than we've ever seen before in Australia, because it's all, it's primarily Australian-owned businesses with international reach, so building games for the international market and building them on our own terms, which is great.
This is something, I guess, for my own knowledge, and I'm sure there are other listeners out there that would like to know, I guess, for the neophyte in the gaming developing world, what's the difference in developing a game on a mobile or tablet interface versus developing a game on a console or PC?
It's a really interesting question, actually, because the borders have become much more blurred over time. You know, it used to be that any game for a console was a full price, you know, retails for $70 to $100, goes out onto store shelves kind of game. And they were big games that had teams of, you know, 50 to 100 working on them. And if you look at, you know, the Assassin's Creed or GTA or something like that now, those team sizes have grown to like 400 or 500.
Yeah.
And the budgets have grown with them, you know. So you're talking about budgets of 50 mil and up.
And that's probably just their social media campaigns.
Well, exactly. You know, that's not counting marketing, which is a huge spend and can be as much again as development. It's not counting distribution. You know, anytime you walk out the door and you see an ad for a video game on a bus, you know that they've spent a bunch of money. You know, if there's a bus driving around, in my case, Brisbane, with Tomb Raider on the side, you know, there's probably buses driving around in every part of the world, and that's a big spend. And they spend a lot on the development. So there's that sort of game development is a completely different picture to mobile development. It's a completely different picture to kind of the normal sort of mobile development we imagine. Teams of, you know, one person doing their own thing, or even, you know, 5 to 10 people making a game for mobile now. team sizes and budgets for mobile games are certainly going up, but they're not at that astronomical level at the moment. But at the same time, you know, there are games like Resogun, which is an indie game that's just come out for PlayStation 4, that's doing quite well, that are made by smaller teams. So there's kind of downloadable games on consoles now as well that are smaller team games. There are small games on PC as well as big games. So it's one of those things where what we used to say was a mobile game, and let's say that's a smallish, you know, 2-3 person game versus a console game, which is like a 100-person team plus game. Those lines are now blurry, and you just have to look at kind of every game and say, well, what was the budget on that? How many people worked on that for how long, and roughly how much did that cost? You know, there are certainly people trying to do AAA gaming in one sense or another on mobile, and likewise there are people doing kind of small, scrappy, indie, artistic stuff on consoles and on PC now as well. So it's all become much more mixed up, which is really cool. You know, there's a little bit of that art house vibe starting to get into the big console games, and a bit of that console polish and execution starting to get into mobile games, and it's really cool to watch at the moment.
We're nearly out of time for this segment, but one final question for the road, Morgan. Where do you see Australia's place in the future of gaming?
I see our place very significantly as discovering what the new thing is and proving that it's worthwhile. The companies and individuals in Australia are small and agile, and they don't rely on external money, which means that where the market moves, people can go really quickly. There's actually another developer in Queensland, Shovesoft, who make a lunar landing style game where you pilot a lunar module on the surface of the moon, and they're doing that for Oculus Rift. And they have the most amazing Oculus Rift game out at the moment, really. And they can do that because the Oculus Rift isn't even out yet. It's not making anybody any money. There's no guarantee that it'll make a ton of money. But they're there because they're interested in it, and because they're not having to obey, you know, an American-owned bunch of shareholders. And that's where our kind of expertise meets enthusiasm to set out into new areas. And that gives us a real advantage because we can get to places before the big players get there, and we can set up some ground. And I don't know what the next wave is, but I do know that whatever it is, it'll have some Australians taking out some territory. We're doing a really good job of being where the frontier is, and I think that's what's going to define us over the next 10 years.
And I'm sure that Defiant Developments is definitely going to be one of those names over the next 10 years. Morgan, thank you so much for that insight.
Sci-Fi and Scream says what year it's been. Ha 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 ha.
Geek. The only way to be on Sci-Fi and Scream. Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.